我主要是负责一部分需要使用 ECMO 来维持生命的非常危重的这部分患者。
This is Chen, an ICU doctor in Wuhan, China. His specialty is ECMO, a type of life support for patients with severe respiratory failure.
实际上送给我这里治疗的都是不能和你正常沟通，没法跟你说话。
By the time the patients reach me, they rarely can talk. They're past the point where they can communicate. But coronavirus patients are unique because they're often still conscious when they reach me. I remember one patient, an older woman with a head of white hair. Out of nowhere, she starts clutching my gown. It really startled me. I didn't know what she was doing. She was looking straight into my eyes. But I realized she was trying to communicate with me. She was begging me to save her. Tears were coming out of her eyes, and I couldn't keep it together myself. I tried to do everything I could to save her. But in the end, I couldn't do it. She was the first COVID patient I lost.
Dr. Chen's patient was one of the first people to die of COVID-19. I'm David Bornstein with BBC World Service, and this is Wuhan, the beginning. In a moment, we'll get to know some of the first people to encounter the coronavirus. If there's one thing I learned from them, it's that the origin of a crisis matters more than you would expect. The things they did led to the present we face now, and possibly offer a glimpse at a future still to come. Over years of living in China, I've always loved Wuhan. But right now, the place is much more tense than usual. In fact, some of the characters in this program have been told not to speak to foreign press. So to protect them, some names have been changed to pseudonyms.
I'm 39. I have a kid. I'm single. I think that sums me up.
This is Wei. He's a journalist in China's small but lively independent press. I asked him when were some of the first times he thought about the virus. He brought me back to a train ride in mid-January.
So it was a normal crowded train, and something interesting happened. The person sitting next to me was a medical worker. I noticed because she was writing an article for a medical journal on her laptop. So the train passes through Wuhan Station. And when that happened, she took out a mask and put it on. And I wondered why she did that. Why would she do that? Like, should I have been doing the same thing? It didn't seem like a big deal at the time, but now it's interesting to look back at that moment.
When Wei took this train in mid-January, medical professionals in Wuhan already knew there was a crisis. But the public had no idea. Even a hyper-plugged-in journalist like Wei wasn't really aware. It was a critical moment. A recent study found that if intervention happened a week earlier than it did, there would have been 2/3 less cases in China. 3 weeks earlier, 95% less cases. Here's Dr. Chen's account of when he first started noticing the hospital was in crisis.
It's actually quite common to encounter new types of pathogens in hospital. For a while, we were seeing a new form of pneumonia. We assumed it was a unique pathogen, but we never imagined we were looking at something like this. The moment that we knew we were facing something serious was around January 10th. After the 10th, incoming patients began to rapidly increase in number. It was clear it was like nothing we'd ever experienced before. I was scared.
It isn't easy for the concerns of doctors to translate into government action, even more so when they're dealing with a brand new disease. It also isn't clear if a Western country would have been better than China at taking quick action. What is clear is that Wuhan hospitals started overflowing with patients on January 10th, yet for the next 8 days, the government announced no new infections.
I did what I could to warn my family and friends. I told everyone on social media to remember to wear a mask when they go outside, to try to protect themselves, but most people didn't really listen to these warnings. People ignored our advice.
Unfortunately for doctors like Chen, there were some people who were listening. Here's Wei, the journalist.
The Wuhan authorities made a lot of mistakes. They reprimanded doctors who tried to speak out on social media about the virus. Police showed up at their homes to make them sign statements of guilt. The doctors were just trying to warn their own colleagues and friends.
Dr. Chen didn't talk about whether he was personally visited by authorities. Many doctors were, but more on that later. The question for now is, why was the Wuhan government so intent on shutting doctors up? You're listening to the opening ceremony of the Hubei Provincial People's Congress, held in Wuhan on January 12th. People's Congresses are like the galas of the Chinese political world. There's pomp, fanfare, and lots of speeches where officials talk about how good of a job they're doing. During a People's Congress, authorities clamp down on free speech. It's a time to be triumphant, not a time to mention an imminent global disaster.
It just so happens that on those days, officially, there were no new cases of the virus. There's no question that there was a cover-up.
I can say that us medical doctors were really getting worried.
From the perspective of the virus, it couldn't have been a better time to be in Wuhan. Just days after the conclusion of the People's Congress was the start of the Lunar New Year, China's most important holiday. Countless people traveled out of Wuhan to return to their hometowns. A 40,000-person potluck buffet was hosted by the city government to kick off the holiday season. But then suddenly, on January 23rd,
Wuhan, China, ground zero for the outbreak, now under lockdown.
Imagine you're a person living in Wuhan. On January 22nd, you're still being told that things are basically under control. Then, one day later, you're given a few hours' notice before you're thrown into what feels like a real-life disaster movie. How did things seem normal one day, then become completely shut down the next? What had just happened in Wuhan? The journalist Wei decided to go there and find out the answers.
You weren't allowed to enter Wuhan unless you were with the state media. It's the same story every time there's a disaster in China. The propaganda department sends out lots of directives restricting what can be reported, who can be interviewed. It's something that's really painful for me.
Despite difficulties, Wei found a way in.
There were no longer any flights to Wuhan. The roads were all sealed. You couldn't get a train ticket in either. But you could buy a ticket to the station after Wuhan. So I bought a ticket to Changsha and waited for the train to stop in Wuhan station. There were government officials and medical workers getting off, so I got off the train and no one knew.
When Wei entered Wuhan, he found a city in a near total state of lockdown. For me, it's hard to imagine this place this way. When I visit Wuhan, it always strikes me as a city bursting with energy. It's actually the punk music capital of China, which makes a lot of sense once you get to know the place. When I think Wuhan, I think of the sign that says Voice of Freedom, hanging outside its main punk venue. I can't help but think it's a bit peculiar that this is also the city that invented the coronavirus lockdown.
We didn't let the residents leave the complex. Actually, we didn't let them leave their front doors.
This is Lan. She helps manage a residential complex in central Wuhan.
We had three guards at the entrance to the neighborhood. If you wanted to leave, you needed to show a proof of necessary employment. In order for it to be valid, you had to get it from your employer, then have it verified by the local government office. There were twice daily disinfections of the entire neighborhood. All incoming mail was also disinfected and delivered straight to people's doors.
Lan works for a private real estate management company. But when the coronavirus hit, the government basically became her new boss.
As soon as the government had a new directive, it would appear on our computers. They'd give guidelines on how the gate guards should keep watch, guidelines on the permits people need to come and go. They pretty much told us how to do everything. It could get tiring.
I asked Lan what directives affected her most personally.
My personal situation was a bit strange. Wuhan has a big river running through it. To get to the other side, you need a special permit. So I haven't been able to get to my own home for a month. It's been tough. I've been living at my office. But even if I sometimes complain, I know that all of this is to protect everyone's health. I think we've all learned to accept it. We might complain, but we would never think about breaking the rules.
I don't think many other countries in the world can do what China did. What other country can ship in 40,000 doctors and nurses into an epidemic's front lines and then lock them in? Even the small details are hard to fathom. These 40,000 medical workers, the countless officials who were sent to lockdown neighbourhoods, how are they fed? The operation behind feeding these people was unimaginably massive. It was a huge organisational effort to give them three boxed meals a day. The government essentially took over all the small restaurants in the town. I have a friend who runs a restaurant in Wuhan. He was producing 10 times the amount of boxed meals as he usually does. It was backbreaking work. The people in the restaurants were working 15-hour days at least.
Some Chinese are proud that the lockdown approach to the coronavirus started in China. But I wonder, what do they think when they see it in action in other countries? Do they see a cheap imitation of a sophisticated Chinese art form?
Other countries just can't do it.
When I caught up with Dr. Chen, he was holed up in a hotel room in central Wuhan.
We were told that we were at high risk of infection, that all of the doctors and nurses from our hospital would have to live in a hotel. The government took over the whole place, cleared of all the previous guests, and we had to live there.
Dr. Chen had gotten married just a few months before the virus broke out. It wasn't easy being separated from his family so soon afterwards.
Personally, it was really tough. After getting married, it's an important tradition in China to spend the first holiday season visiting your spouse's relatives. I couldn't help but feel a bit ashamed, even if I knew that it was right to be fulfilling my duties at the hospital. When we arrive at the hospital to start our shift, we get a briefing while changing into our protective gear. It takes more than 30 minutes to get changed. It's really complicated. After you put on all three layers of gear, you can enter the isolation ward. No one was used to wearing so many layers. It made you clumsy and slow. As a precaution against aerosol transmission, the hospital halted the use of air conditioning, so it got extremely stuffy. After 5 minutes, your goggles would get completely fogged up. You couldn't even read reports. We had to rely on the nurses to orally recite information. We'd be in there for what seemed like forever. So exhausting. When you walk out, you're covered in sweat from head to toe.
At first, I didn't quite appreciate how difficult it is to treat a new disease. Doctors in Wuhan had to figure out a course of treatment from the ground up.
The disease primarily affects the respiratory system, but what's unique is its rapid progression. For many patients, they're speaking normally in the morning, but by the evening, they're in respiratory failure and passing away. It's tricky to treat something like this. We had to unlearn a lot of habits. Usually, there's a standard procedure for respiratory failure. First, you give the patient oxygen. If things get worse, you consider giving the patient manual ventilation. If the situation then gets worse, we move the patient to intubation and mechanical ventilation. As a last resort, we move the patient to ECMO.
If you weren't aware, intubation refers to putting patients on mechanical ventilators. ECMO is the procedure in which oxygen is pumped directly into the blood.
This is the progression that we always follow for patients facing respiratory failure, but you can't follow this procedure for COVID-19. You need to be more aggressive in giving life support early. We discovered this too late for many patients. We would give a patient with mild COVID oxygen, then the next time we checked on them, things would be extremely serious, in need of ECMO. People died because we just didn't have the time.
The Wuhan medical community generated some of the first knowledge on how to treat COVID, but they did more than that. Why is it that Wuhan shut down so suddenly after weeks of local authorities denying the scope of the problem? Reports indicate that national CDC officials in Beijing learned about the virus via online rumors. Social media posts from people like Dr. Chen may have been what got word out of Wuhan. Here's Wei, the journalist, once more.
Restrictions on free speech and social media have been getting more and more severe here in China, but I think maybe this may have been a harsh lesson for the authorities. There should be more room for professionals to voice their opinion about their own field. I'm not even talking about complete freedom of speech, even though that's what I want, that even though that's what I'm working towards. I know that isn't possible now. But why can't a professional voice, an expert, have an opinion about their own field? How is that not even permitted?
I was curious why Wei would want to speak to BBC World Service about freedom of speech in China, but it may have been because there's suddenly some space for it. In the midst of this crisis, China's liberal press succeeded in creating a conversation about speaking truth to power. Wei was one of several Chinese journalists to write about a whistleblower doctor named Li Wenliang. Li was part of a group of doctors punished by authorities for warning about the virus on social media. On February 7th, he passed away after contracting the virus himself.
The night that Li Wenliang died, I was at the hospital where he worked. It was really quiet. An ICU nurse told me that Li Wenliang had died. But they didn't officially announce it until the next day. It's kind of interesting, right? In China, doctors aren't allowed to declare that you're dead. Only the state can give you the permission to die. When he died, I published an article about him. I didn't expect it to be as big news as it was. The next day, people were showing up at the hospital, placing flowers and whistles at a makeshift memorial. People stood outside the hospital, blowing whistles in solidarity. It was such a powerful thing to see. I took a video of it. I'll send it to you. I think this sound will be remembered by many Chinese people for a really long time. Something like 40 million people watched the video I put online. Everyone was talking about it. People were furious that he was punished before he died. What shocked me is that a lot of government officials, high-ranking officials, the kind of people who never voiced their opinions, they were asking me about Li Wenliang. Even they were outraged about what had happened.
The the Wuhan government's lack of transparency may have lost them their chance to contain the virus. But thanks to whistleblowers and journalists, China was rallied into action nonetheless. If not for them, the virus could have been unchecked long enough for it to explode out of China. The rest of the world could have had days rather than months to prepare. But the cost for people at the front lines was high.
All the doctors in Wuhan, we're all classmates. In Wuhan, there's a really famous medical school. Nearly all doctors studied there or have some sort of relation to it. Everybody knows everybody. There was one surgeon at our hospital, an old professor. I took his class when I was a medical student. There was a period when I did surgeries at his side. He caught it, and it progressed really fast. I treated him myself. When he passed away, we all took it really hard. We did everything we could to save him, but we couldn't do it. We couldn't save him. Fighting this disease, it's a really heavy burden.
Wuhan was the first city, the first to treat the virus, the first to lock itself down. Its approach to the epidemic was emulated by countless other places. And that brings us into the present. Now, Wuhan needs to decide what life looks like after the virus's first wave. People are calling it the new normal. But if there's one thing it isn't, it's normal. This is Fan, a resident in Wuhan. She talked to me about all the new regulations popping up to prevent further spread of the virus.
It's starting with people going back to work. If you want to go back to work, you need to download an app on your phone which tracks your health. It assigns you a score. If you're healthy, it'll show as green. The way it works is if you get on a subway car or bus with a patient who is revealed to be sick, your status will turn from green to either yellow or red. It's always tracking you to see where you are.
Watchdog groups are warning that the criteria used to determine health ratings are lacking transparency. Are they determined through the info you self-report? Clues found while it digs through your phone? Your location data?
Once you're red or yellow, you can't really go anywhere. There's stations to scan your app info before you walk in anywhere. Your job, shopping centres, the subway, you all have to scan. If you're red, they won't even let you leave your apartment complex. I feel like we're being watched like never before. It's our actual bodies that are being watched. It's like a science fiction movie.
Google and Apple are working on a similar app. But can it be effective if privacy laws get in the way? Some people say that Asian democracies like Taiwan and South Korea show that you can manage the virus while maintaining individual freedoms. But it isn't that simple. Those places have relied on surveillance systems just like this.
I'm not a fan of authoritarianism like what you see here in China. In fact, it really bothers me. I oppose it. But with my own eyes, I just saw this system being incredibly effective in the face of a disaster. It's efficient. It gets results. It's true that the system made so many mistakes in the beginning of the epidemic. The lack of transparency and the lack of freedom of speech creates dangerous situations. But once the gears started moving, China put the full force of its system into solving the problem. A system with force that other countries don't have. It did a lot in very little time. And we should never forget the tragedies, the stories that the system tries to cover up. We shouldn't forget the way it crushes those who dissent, but at the same time, the system conquered the virus. You can't deny it saved many lives.
People in Wuhan can go into the world and feel pretty safe. Daily new cases in China have dropped to the double digits, and nearly all of them are from overseas arrivals. Looking at Italy, Spain, the United States, it seems that us in other countries won't be able to do what China did. And I'm not sure if we'd want it. Are we willing to post guards at apartment complexes? Track people online with reckless abandon? our freedoms might just be getting in the way of defeating this virus. But on the other hand, what good is freedom if because of it, you're too scared to leave your house? As this thing drags on, a lot more places might end up following in Wuhan's footsteps. I conducted the interviews in this program via phone in early April. On the night I talked to Dr. Chen, it was the day before he finally was able to go home.
So I've just completed my rotation at the front line. Now I'm still in the hotel, where I'll be isolated for another 14 days. After this is over, they'll give me a CT scan and test me for the virus. After all that's over, I'm going to go home and eat a steak.
When I talked to Wei, he was preparing to return home after 2 months in Wuhan.
I wasn't around for some important things back home. I feel helpless. I missed my son's birthday. While here in Wuhan, my grandmother passed away. I was in lockdown during the funeral. I know that there was no way for me to exit the city. Once I was in, I couldn't get out, but like everything else, you just have to accept it. You just got to take it.
Thank you for listening. There will be more from the documentary podcast soon. The documentary is just one of our BBC World Service podcasts. There are many others to choose from.
In recent weeks and months, the news has seemed pretty dark and depressing. But throughout this pandemic, people around the world have been finding ways to keep their spirits up.
Like when you're sitting around, like at home, nothing to do, when you turn the music on, you just listen to it, time just flies by.
The Global News Podcast invited listeners to share their stories with us, whether it's turning to music, nature, craft, doing good deeds, or even being attacked by geese.
Every morning, I'm listening to the BBC podcast on this lake, and every morning, these guys attack me.
There are lots more inspiring and intriguing stories in our special episode, which we're calling Postcards from Isolation.
It's a break from the non-stop headline.
That's the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Global News Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and look for our special episode, Postcards from Isolation, released on Monday, the 11th of May.